from dates, not to the honey produced from bees. Milk and honey were considered among the chief necessities of human life in the ancient Near East, and their combination was thought to constitute a highly nutritious diet, milk being rich in protein and the dried date rich in carbohydrates. Indeed, some Arab tribes are known to subsist for months at a time solely on milk and honey. The only sovereign states that have ever existed in Canaan were Jewish states. Verse 8 continued, "The region of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites." Note that Canaan was not the land or country of the Canaanites. It was a land with seven nations. See Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 1. Meaning the land of Canaan was never historically identified with one people until the Israelites, Jews, made it their state. The Israelites were the first to claim Canaan as a national homeland. And for more than 3,000 years since, the only sovereign states in Canaan have been Jewish states. The first one lasted from the time of King David, around 1000 BCE, until 586 BCE, when the Babylonians destroyed the first temple. The second Jewish state lasted from about two generations after 586 BCE, until its destruction by the Romans in about the year 70. And the third Jewish state was established in 1948 as the modern state of Israel. Verse 9. "Now the cry of the Israelites has reached me. Moreover, I have seen how the Egyptians oppress them." This verse is essentially a repetition of verse 7. Perhaps God refers again to the suffering of Israelites in order to impress upon Moses the need for him to step up and lead the people. Verse 10. "Come, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh, and you shall free my people, the Israelites, from Egypt." Verse 11. "But Moses said to God, 'Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and free the Israelites from Egypt?'" One can only imagine Moses' shock. He is leading a completely normal shepherd's life when, out of nowhere, God himself appears to him and asks him to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. Moses responds with a statement of total humility. It is often said that in order to successfully run for president of the United States, a person has to have the requisite fire in the belly. Moses was the antithesis of this model. During the American Revolution, a relatively common phrase was the meekness of Moses, which described the humility many were looking for in their prospective leaders. In a 1776 letter to a fellow revolutionary, John Adams, later to be the second president of the United States, wrote, "The management of so complicated and mighty a machine as the United Colonies requires the meekness of Moses, the patience of Job, and the wisdom of Solomon added to the valor of Daniel." In that sentence, the reader will also note, once again, the central role the Hebrew Bible played for the founders of the United States. Verse 12. "And he said, 'I will be with you.'" In addition, Moses knows he is wanted for murder in Egypt, Exodus chapter 2, verse 15. He is presumably terrified of appearing before a king who wants to kill him. Nevertheless, he does not object to God's assignment on the grounds it would endanger his life. But God knows fear plays a role in Moses' thinking, and reassures him, "I will be with you." In the next chapter, God is more explicit in addressing this fear. "All the men who sought to kill you are dead." Exodus chapter 4, verse 16. These words, "I will be with you," seem to be a non sequitur. Moses just asked God, who was he to be chosen for such an awesome task? Yet instead of listing Moses' qualifications, God says, "I will be with you." Perhaps God is telling Moses that who he is and what his qualifications are do not matter. He was chosen for his qualifications, but he will succeed because God will be with him. Verse 12 continued, "That shall be your sign that it was I who sent you, and when you have freed the people from Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain." The sign that it was I who sent you is the people will be freed from Egypt and worship God at this mountain. That is how things usually work. God's signs, his interventions in individuals' or nations' lives, are seen most clearly only in retrospect. In the case of the Jews, for example, when one reflects on over 3,600 years of Jewish survival and influence on the world, it is difficult not to see the hand of God. However, given the terrible suffering Jews have endured at the hands of Jew haters for millennia, for a Jew at any particular moment, it has not been easy to see God's hand. Perhaps this is one meaning of the biblical verse, that we can only see God from the back. Exodus chapter 33, verse 23. Only after an event happens can we see God's hand in it. The Israelites have to be released from serving Pharaoh in order to serve God. This is consistent with Moses' later demand to Pharaoh, made in God's name, "Let my people go, that they may worship, serve me." Exodus chapter 9, verse 1. Verse 13. Moses said to God, "When I come to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" Moses' first objection to God's command was, "Who am I?" In this verse, he raises his second objection, "Who are you?" Moses' question signifies the Israelites have strayed so far from their faith, they probably no longer even know God's name, or much else about God. They know only that they have an ancestral God. The medieval commentator Rashbam assumed Moses did not know God's name at this point. After all, why would he? How would he? Having grown up in the Egyptian royal household, presumably the gods he knew of were the Egyptian gods, and now the Midianite gods. Therefore, Moses might have put the question in the mouths of the Israelites to cover his own ignorance. On the other hand, Moses might have simply been expressing an honest desire to more fully understand God, a quest we should all undertake. Rabbi Harold Kushner comments, "It may be hard for the modern reader to understand the point of this question. Moses is not changing the subject and saying to God, 'Excuse me, what is your name? I didn't get it the first time.' In ancient times, a name was more than an identifying label. Your name was your essence, what you were all about, your identity rather than just your identification. To ask what is God's name is to ask, what is God all about? What does he stand for?" God's name is a verb, to be. Verse 14. And God said to Moses, "Eyah asher eyah." He continued, "Thus shall you say to the Israelites, 'Eyah sent me to you.'" This is one of the great moments of the Torah. Just like Moses, we are all expectantly awaiting God's answer. At this sublime moment of divine revelation, God identifies himself with a name having four possible meanings, each one perfectly accurate. I am what I am. I am who I am. I will be what I will be. I will be who I will be. The reason all four translations are accurate is Hebrew does not have a word for the present tense of the verb to be. In other words, there is no Hebrew word for am or is or are. Therefore, in order to say I am Joseph, for example, one would say Ani Joseph, I Joseph. The absence of the present tense of to be is not unique to Hebrew. It is also true of Arabic and Russian, among other languages. So here, when God uses the future tense of the verb to be, it literally means I will be. But it is often translated as I am because there is no present tense of the verb to be in Hebrew. Importantly, this name I am who I am or I will be who I will be is never again mentioned in the Torah. This suggests God was giving Moses an answer for Moses, not for the Israelites. Such an abstract name would have made no sense to the theologically primitive Israelites. Even though God tells Moses to tell the Israelites, "Eyah, am or will be sent him," that name is really for Moses. Moses is not going to get the Israelites to follow him by telling them, "I am sent me to lead you," as is made clear in the next verse, when God gives Moses a far more relatable name to use. God's response is not only for Moses. It is also for us who are reading this thousands of years later. It is important to remember the Torah has the almost impossible task of being relevant to slaves living in the Bronze Age, to people in our time, and to our descendants. That it has succeeded in doing so is another reason I regard the Torah as not man-made. While the term "I am what I am" or "I will be who I will be" is not used again, the most commonly used name for God in the Torah and the rest of the Hebrew Bible is essentially the verb to be. It is composed of the Hebrew letters YHVH, from where we get the word Jehovah, and it is always translated Lord because it is pronounced Adonai, meaning Lord, even though YHVH actually means being or will be or even just is. Given that in the Torah names indicate essence, YHVH tells us the essence of God is being. God simply cannot be explained any further. Anything else anthropomorphizes God. God simply is. Verse 15. And God said further to Moses, "Thus shall you speak to the Israelites. The Lord, YHVH, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This shall be my name forever, this my appellation for all eternity." God recognizes that a tribal ancestral identity is absolutely necessary for the Israelite slaves to be able to relate to him and to know who he is. Therefore, God tells Moses to identify him in these terms, and not, for example, as creator of the universe, let alone as "I am who I am" when speaking to the people. Verse 16, "Go and assemble the elders of Israel and say to them." Moses has three groups of people to convince of God's message: Pharaoh, the Israelite slaves, and the elders of Israel, a category whose identity is not clear. Were they also slaves? Presumably yes, but we don't know. In any case, the term elders suggests they were credited with wisdom, and therefore regarded with respect, which is how older people have been regarded in almost every society. In recent years, many societies have lost reverence for the old. The reason is wisdom, certainly in comparison with knowledge, is often undervalued or not valued at all. And one reason for that is knowledge is far more valued due to extraordinary advances in technology, medicine, and science. Likewise, intelligence is far more valued than wisdom. Think of how many parents want their children to be brilliant versus how many parents want their children to be wise. In truth, few parents even think in terms of wise, a term that cannot be measured on tests. The loss to society has been immeasurable. Societies need wisdom far more than knowledge. Indeed, knowledge without wisdom is likely to lead to catastrophe. Think of how societies like Nazi Germany, the USSR, North Korea, and the Iranian mullahs misused both their intelligence and their knowledge. Verse 16 continued, "The Lord, YHVH, the God Elohe of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me and said." God is telling Moses to use both the personal name YHVH, Jehovah, and the universal name Elohim in introducing God to the elders. Verse 16 continued, "I have taken note of you and of what is being done to you in Egypt." At the end of Genesis, Joseph uses these same words in his deathbed prophecy to his brothers. He promises them that God will take note of them and deliver them from Egypt to the promised land. See Genesis chapter 50, verse 24. Given that traditions about Joseph probably still circulated in the Israelite community, these words would have been very comforting and would have given Moses credibility when he introduced himself to the Israelites. Verse 17, "And I have declared, I will take you out of the misery of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, to a land flowing with milk and honey." Verse 18, "They will listen to you. Then you shall go with the elders of Israel to the king of Egypt, and you shall say to him, 'The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, manifested himself to us.'" God tells Moses to refer to him as the God of the Hebrews, because this was a term Pharaoh would understand. In the ancient world, gods were only gods of clans and peoples. There was no concept of a single god of all mankind. This was among the revolutionary ideas the Torah introduced to humanity. Verse 18 continued, "Now therefore, let us go a distance of 3 days into the wilderness." God does not want Moses to ask for the complete freeing of the Israelites from slavery. Pharaoh would never accede to such a radical request. Instead, Moses is told to ask Pharaoh to permit the Israelites at least a week-long sabbatical, 3 days out, time for sacrifices, and 3 days back. The Hebrew word na, which appears in the Hebrew text, and which means please, is not translated here. God is actually instructing Moses to be polite in his request of Pharaoh. "Now therefore, please, let us go." Verse 18 continued, "to sacrifice to the Lord our God." Moses' request will be anathema to Pharaoh for several reasons. One is it is an affront to Egyptian religion, in which many animals were worshipped as gods. Essentially, Moses would be asking Pharaoh for permission to slaughter Egyptian gods as an offering to the Israelite God. The Torah views animal sacrifice as an appropriate way of serving God. As previously noted, the Torah's view is animals were created for human beings to use for morally legitimate purposes and not to abuse. It is also worth noting, according to Torah law, nearly all sacrificed animals were to be eaten, meaning sacrifices were also a form of public slaughter. My understanding of the rationale for animal sacrifice is explained in the commentary on the book of Leviticus, large sections of which deal with sacrifice. Verse 19, "Yet I know that the king of Egypt will let you go only because of a greater might." God tells Moses Pharaoh will only free the Israelites after Pharaoh is confronted by a formidable show of force. In predicting Pharaoh's behavior, God may seem to be curtailing Pharaoh's freedom of choice. However, the Jewish notion of free will allows for divine foreknowledge. As one of the greatest teachers in Jewish history, Rabbi Akiva, explains in the Talmud, "All is foreseen, yet free will is granted. Hakol safui vaharashut natuna." To put it in contemporary terms, God stands outside of time. Verse 20. "So I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with various wonders, which I will work upon them. After that, he shall let you go." In the final analysis, all of the negotiating is ultimately a charade. Pharaoh will free the Israelites only because of the plagues God will inflict on Egypt. However, God and Moses must first offer Pharaoh the option of freeing the slaves without having to suffer those plagues. God must act justly, and therefore cannot inflict the plagues until Pharaoh has made them morally justified. Verse 21, "And I will dispose the Egyptians favorably toward this people, so that when you go, you will not go away empty-handed." Verse 22, "Each woman shall borrow from her neighbor and the lodger in her house objects of silver and gold and clothing, and you shall put these on your sons and daughters, thus stripping the Egyptians." The word translated here as "shall borrow" literally means ask, and can also be translated as request. God does not say the women should make demands of their neighbors, even though they are surely entitled to these valuables after hundreds of years of slavery. The women must behave with decency even toward their oppressors. Even victims must act ethically. And that surely is one of the great Torah lessons relevant to the time in which we live. Ironically, it was almost certainly that jewelry the Israelites later used in building the golden calf. Exodus chapter 32, verses 2 through 3. Chapter 4, Moses' third objection. Verse 1. "But Moses spoke up and said, 'What if they do not believe me and do not listen to me, but say, the Lord did not appear to you?'" Moses raises a third objection. He first objected that he did not consider himself, a shepherd in Midian, the appropriate person to go before Pharaoh. See Exodus chapter 3, verse 11. He then objected that he did not even know God's right name or how to refer to the deity who was sending him. See Exodus chapter 3, verse 13. Moses' third objection presents a more serious challenge. God will now give Moses a demonstration of how he will prove to doubters in Egypt both his presence and power. Verse 2. The Lord said to him, "What is that in your hand?" And he replied, "A rod." Before converting Moses' rod into a snake, God has Moses confirm it is an ordinary rod. Verse 3, he said, "Cast it on the ground." He cast it on the ground, and it became a snake, and Moses recoiled from it. Verse 4, then the Lord said to Moses, "Put out your hand and grasp it by the tail." He put out his hand and seized it, and it became a rod in his hand. In asking Moses to grasp the snake by its tail, God is testing Moses' faith. As a shepherd, Moses knows a snake should be held by the neck to prevent it from striking. He is therefore taking a risk in obeying God's command. Verse 5, that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, did appear to you. Verse 6, the Lord said to him further, "Put your hand into your bosom." He put his hand into his bosom, and when he took it out, his hand was encrusted with snowy scales. Throughout history, the skin disease of snowy scales has often been translated as leprosy, though we now know that while it is an affliction of the skin, it is not leprosy. The comparison to snow is not about its whiteness, but its flakiness. Sarna notes, apart from the startling phenomenon of the sudden appearance and, in the next verse, disappearance of the encrustation, this particular sign had an ominous aspect to it. It is seen in the Bible as a divine punishment for human behavior. Numbers chapter 12, verses 10 through 16, describes Moses' sister Miriam being afflicted with this punishment. And 2 Chronicles chapter 26, verses 16 through 21, depicts the Judean king Uzziahu or Uzziah, 8th century BCE, as being similarly punished. Zeraat, this skin disease, broke out on his forehead, for the Lord had struck him with a plague. It is likely God performs this miracle to warn Moses that he is starting to tire of all his objections, and to subtly remind him he has the power to punish those who do not obey him. Verse 7. And he said, "Put your hand back into your bosom." He put his hand back into his bosom, and when he took it out of his bosom, there it was again, like the rest of his body. Verse 8. And if they do not believe you or pay heed to the first sign, they will believe the second. Verse 9. And if they are not convinced by both these signs and still do not heed you, take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and it, the water that you take from the Nile, will turn to blood on the dry ground. Unlike the first two signs, this one cannot be performed before Moses' eyes, because he is standing in the desert rather than beside the Nile. Moses takes the promise of this sign on faith. Verse 10. But Moses said to the Lord, "Please, O Lord, I have never been a man of words, either in times past or now that you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and slow of tongue." In the three stories related about Moses in chapter 2, he intervened successfully by smiting the Egyptian overseer who was beating the Hebrew slave, and he intervened successfully when he stood up on behalf of the bullied shepherdesses of Midian. The one time he was unsuccessful was when he tried to use words to stop the two quarreling Israelites. Exodus chapter 2, verses 13 through 14. Verse 11. And the Lord said to him, "Who gives man speech? Who makes him dumb or deaf, seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord?" When Moses pleads that he is inarticulate, God is not impressed. Verse 12. Now go. The Hebrew is very direct, even abrupt. God essentially says to Moses, "Get going." One of the most influential leaders in history didn't speak well. Verse 12 continued, "And I will be with you as you speak and will instruct you what to say." Moses is chosen for his moral greatness rather than for his charisma or eloquence. He's chosen not because he sounds good, but because he is good. It does not matter to God that Moses does not speak well, because he is, in any event, going to be a vehicle for God's words. Indeed, perhaps God deliberately chooses a leader who does not speak well, to show that the message is so much more important than the medium. In our day, the opposite is often the case. The medium, in Marshall McLuhan's famous words, is the message. In any event, it is only fair to note it is God's plagues, more than Moses' and Aaron's words, that convince Pharaoh to allow the Jews to leave Egypt. And didn't want to be a leader. Verse 13. But he said, "Please, O Lord, make someone else your agent." After four carefully reasoned objections, Moses finally admits the truth. He just doesn't want this dangerous, arduous, all-consuming mission that will completely change his life. He's like the child who gives a dozen reasons to explain why he cannot do his homework, and then finally gets to the truth, "I just don't want to do it." This fifth objection is a final desperate plea. In this sense, Moses is an ideal leader, because he doesn't really want the job. Throughout history, most national leaders ached to be powerful, influential, famous, rich. Moses either preferred to lead a simple life with his family, or feared returning to Egypt, or both. Verse 14. The Lord became angry with Moses, and he said, "There is your brother Aaron the Levite. He, I know, speaks readily. Even now he is setting out to meet you." Finally, God loses patience with Moses' objections, though he does offer him a significant consolation. Moses will not have to undertake the mission alone, and his partner, his brother Aaron, does speak well. Verse 14 continued, "And he will be happy to see you." Verse 15, "You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth. I will be with you and with him as you speak and tell both of you what to do." Verse 16, "And he shall speak for you to the people. Thus he shall serve as your spokesman, with you playing the role of God to him." Verse 17, "And take with you this rod with which you shall perform the signs." That rod will accompany Moses for the rest of his life, serving both as a link to his first encounter with God at the burning bush and as a reminder of his humble origins as a shepherd. Moses will remain a shepherd, though his new flock will be the Hebrew nation. That Moses wages the battle with the Egyptians using a simple shepherd's rod rather than sophisticated weaponry is reminiscent of the sling and the five smooth stones with which the young shepherd David confronted and prevailed over the Philistine giant Goliath. 1 Samuel chapter 17, verses 40 through 51. With God on their side, Moses and David overcame foes far mightier than the Israelites on whose behalf they fought. Verse 18. Moses went back to his father-in-law Yeter and said to him, "Let me go back to my kinsmen in Egypt and see how they are faring." There are two possible explanations as to why Moses solicits his father-in-law's permission. One is he may have needed his father-in-law's official permission to take Zipporah from her father's house. The other more likely explanation is Moses was exhibiting good manners in formally making this request. Moses was, as we shall see later, Exodus chapter 18, extremely close to Jethro. Why doesn't Moses tell his father-in-law about his encounter with God? Moses deliberately neglects to mention he has just had a divine encounter in which God told him to confront Pharaoh and deliver the Israelites from Egyptian bondage. Moses probably feared such a declaration would not have been well received by his father-in-law. Jethro might well have regarded him as emotionally unbalanced, or if he did believe Moses, might object to Moses taking on such a dangerous mission and bringing Jethro's daughter and two grandchildren with him. It is hard to imagine another reason Moses would not have told his father-in-law about his encounter with God. Verse 18 continued, "And Jethro said to Moses, 'Go in peace.'" Jethro could understand and relate to the importance of brotherly and tribal bonds, so he permits Moses to return to his kin without hesitation. We cannot know how much Jethro knew regarding the persecution of the Israelites or the possible danger to his son-in-law once he returned to Egypt. Verse 19. The Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt, for all the men who sought to kill you are dead." God, who knows people's thoughts, understood Moses was likely afraid of being executed if he returned to Egypt. Therefore, God reassures him he no longer has reason to fear for his life. Verse 20. So Moses took his wife and sons, mounted them on an ass, and went back to the land of Egypt, and Moses took the rod of God with him. The Torah has until now only mentioned the birth of a single son. Apparently Moses has at least one other. See Exodus chapter 18, verse 4. Did God deprive Pharaoh of free will? Verse 21. And the Lord said to Moses, "When you return to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the marvels that I have put within your power. I, however, will stiffen his heart so that he will not let the people go." The Torah refers 20 times to the stiffening or hardening of Pharaoh's heart. Half of them are attributed to Pharaoh's decisions to harden his heart, and half of them attributed to God hardening Pharaoh's heart. The latter instances have troubled readers throughout the ages. Is it fair to punish someone, in this case Pharaoh, who is not acting freely because God has strengthened his heart? There are at least two ways of dealing with this problem. One, God believed Pharaoh deserved to be punished. Had Pharaoh released the Israelites after a single plague, God would not have been able to adequately punish him and the Egyptian nation for enslaving the Israelites for hundreds of years and for the mass murder of the infant boys, all of which, it should be noted, they did out of free will, well before God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Two, strengthening Pharaoh's heart is precisely what gave Pharaoh free will. Had God not strengthened Pharaoh's heart, Pharaoh would have released the Israelites after one or at most two or three plagues. But such a release would have no more been an act of free will than it is free will when a man gives a confession while being tortured or signs a contract with a gun pointed at his head, as in the famous words from Mario Puzo's novel, The Godfather, "I'll make him an offer he can't refuse." God's strengthening allowed Pharaoh to do what, in his heart, he really wanted to do, refuse to give up his slaves. See the commentary to Exodus chapter 10, verse 7, for proof that God's hardening of Pharaoh's heart did not deprive the king of his free will. Verse 22. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son." All the nations of the world are God's children. Israel is the firstborn because the Israelites were the people to whom God first introduced himself. Verse 23, "I have said to you, let my son go that he may worship me, yet you refuse to let him go." Essay: The difference between belief in God and faith in God. Verse 23 continued, "Now I will slay your firstborn son." Few readers, even veteran students of the Bible, recall the killing of Pharaoh's firstborn son, which transpired during the 10th plague, was mentioned by God to Moses even before the plagues began. But Moses does not repeat those words to Pharaoh at this point. Perhaps he feared it would provoke Pharaoh to kill him. If that is indeed the reason Moses does not fulfill this explicit order from God, it would reveal that at that point, he lacked complete faith God would protect him. He would come to faith later, but at this point, both God and his promises were quite new to Moses. In a sense, then, one could say even God has to establish credibility to be fully trusted. Which raises the issue of trust, or faith, in God. There are two distinct meanings to the statement, "I believe in God." The first meaning is, "I believe God exists." The second meaning is, "I trust in God." The first is the most common meaning, but it is not nearly as important as the second. To believe God exists, but not have trust or faith in him, is the same as believing another person exists, but not having trust in that person. The importance of trust in God has been so fundamental to American history, for example, that one of the two mottos of the United States since the 19th century has been, "In God we trust." The other is E Pluribus Unum, Latin for from many, one. The motto's words were carefully chosen. They were not, we believe in God. So then, what does trust or faith in God mean? Does it mean, as many people assume, trusting God will help us whenever we are in trouble? Clearly, that cannot be the case. An innumerable number of people who have trusted in God have not been helped, certainly not in any direct way, by God when they were in trouble. If God always intervened as we wished, there would be no unjust suffering in this world. No disease, no evil, and no death. And one should add, no free will. But of course, there is an immeasurable amount of unjust suffering. If pain were water, the world would drown. Therefore, trust in God must mean, first and foremost, that we believe God cares about each one of us, and in some way he will ultimately do right by us. And that in turn means, in the final analysis, since injustice often prevails in this world, there must be an afterlife, a life in which a just God makes sure justice prevails. But trusting God also means more than belief in an afterlife. Believers also trust that God will, at times of his choosing, intervene in this world, though not necessarily in the lifetime of any specific individual who might beseech God's intervention. For example, Jews have trusted for thousands of years that God would ensure the Jews would one day return to their homeland, and they did. And of course, such trust does not only apply to Jews. Many people, myself included, believe God intervened in some way to inspire the founding of the United States of America, a country founded by Christians rooted in the Hebrew Bible. It is not surprising, therefore, that the only verse inscribed on the most iconic symbol of the American Revolution, the Liberty Bell, is from the Torah. "You shall proclaim liberty throughout the land for all its inhabitants." Leviticus chapter 25, verse 10. America became the one truly Judeo-Christian country. Verse 24. At a night encampment on the way, the Lord encountered him and sought to kill him. In an age when the rite of circumcision is under attack in some non-traditional circles, this episode reminds us how seriously God takes the one specific commandment he enjoined on Abraham. Genesis chapter 17, verses 9 through 12. Nahum Sarna maintains that the obscure incident documented in this verse and the two following it are probably a truncated version of a larger popular story circulated orally in Israel. The story is missing several important details. Most notably, we cannot be certain whom God sought to kill or why. Umberto Casuto, an Italian Jewish Bible scholar who was a professor of Bible at the Hebrew University, argued it was Moses, not the son, God sought to kill, perhaps as a punishment for failing to circumcise his son. In either case, Zipporah understood that circumcising their son was necessary, and Moses' life, or according to some, his son's life, is once again saved by a woman. Verse 25. So Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin, and touched his legs with it, saying, "You are truly a bridegroom of blood to me." The story underscores the centrality of circumcision to Jewish identity. Thousands of years after this event, the philosopher Benedict Spinoza, a Jew who was so alienated from the Jewish community and so hostile to Judaism he was among the few Jews ever to be excommunicated from and never readmitted to the Jewish community, maintained that as long as the Jews practice circumcision, they will survive as a distinct people. Although circumcision was widely practiced among the ancient Semites and in Egypt, the Torah elevated the act by infusing it with new meaning. For the religious meaning of circumcision, see the essay In Defense of Circumcision at the end of the commentary to Genesis chapter 17. The fact circumcision was practiced in other cultures demonstrates the vitally important point that it is the significance of a ritual, not the ritual itself, that matters. Anti-religious writers often cite religious rituals and holy days that were also practiced by pagans in order to denigrate those rituals and holy days, and by extension, religion. But what higher religion does is use familiar rituals, practices, and themes and infuses them with moral and elevated spiritual meaning. Verse 26. And when he let him alone, she added, a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision. It is unclear what this phrase, a bridegroom of blood, really means, or even whom Zipporah is addressing, especially since Hatan, bridegroom, also means to protect in Arabic. Sarna contends Zipporah is in effect telling their son, you are now circumcised and so protected for me by means of the blood of circumcision. Others hold she is addressing Moses, who is, after all, her bridegroom. Verse 27. The Lord said to Aaron, go to meet Moses in the wilderness. He went and met him at the mountain of God, and he kissed him. The repetition of the words mountain of God suggests Aaron met Moses at the same mountain where God appeared to Moses in the burning bush. Exodus chapter 3, verse 1. Verse 28. Moses told Aaron about all the things that the Lord had committed to him and all the signs about which he had instructed him. There are three signs: the transformation of the rod into a snake, the transformation of a healthy hand into a diseased hand, and the transformation of water into blood. Exodus chapter 4, verses 1 through 9. Verse 29. Then Moses and Aaron went and assembled all the elders of the Israelites. Verse 30. Aaron repeated all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and he performed the signs in the sight of the people. Verse 31. And the people were convinced. When they heard that the Lord had taken note of the Israelites, and that he had seen their plight, they bowed low in homage. The people believed Moses and Aaron after they witnessed the signs. Today, such signs would likely be dismissed by most people, myself among them, as magic tricks. This is not to say God no longer directly communicates with human beings, only that in an age of science and skepticism, people are less likely to be persuaded by miracles and revelations than in the past. Chapter 5. Where did all the elders go? Verse 1. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh. God had told Moses to go to Pharaoh with the elders. Exodus chapter 3, verse 18. But the elders are not mentioned in this verse. According to Rashi, the leading medieval Jewish Bible commentator, France, 1040 to 1105, the elders started out with Moses and Aaron, but they dropped out one by one, two by two, as they grew increasingly fearful of appearing before the God King, who was not likely to take kindly to Moses' demands. By the time Moses and Aaron reached Pharaoh, none of the elders remained to accompany them. Exodus chapter 5, verse 4. Whether or not this is precisely what happened, their fear of confronting the king of Egypt is the best explanation I can think of to account for the elders' absence. Why, then, did they drop out? One possible reason is people tend to grow more fearful with age. As we get older, the reality of death becomes ever clearer, and with it a greater appreciation for the value of life. Older people are therefore less likely than young people to undertake a life-endangering mission. If you want caution, wisdom, and strategic thinking, you are more likely to get it from older people. If you want physical courage and risk-taking, you are more likely to get it from younger people. And there are times, such as is the case here, when physical courage is the more valuable attribute. Another possible reason for the elders not accompanying Moses has not so much to do with courage as it does with faith. Moses was assured by God that he would take care of him. I will be with you, Exodus chapter 3, verse 12, and even enabled him to perform miracles. The elders had no such direct assurance from God. Moses doesn't talk to Pharaoh as he was told to. Verse 1 continued, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel. Moses does not use the name God instructed him to use, the Lord God of the Hebrews, Exodus chapter 3, verse 18. As becomes apparent in the next comment, this is one of several ways in which Moses initially fails to heed the exact instructions given by God at the burning bush. Verse 1 continued, let my people go, that they may celebrate a festival for me in the wilderness. God had told Moses to politely ask Pharaoh for permission to leave Egypt for a brief period. Moses was even supposed to use the word please, na in Hebrew, see Exodus chapter 3, verse 18. Instead, Moses and Aaron simply demand that Pharaoh release the Israelites. They also neglect to specify they are asking permission for only a limited period, about a week, see commentary on Exodus chapter 3, verse 18. This is not to suggest that had Moses spoken precisely as God instructed, he would have elicited a different response from Pharaoh. But given the demanding tone and the unspecified amount of time, it is no wonder Pharaoh immediately responds so dismissively. Verse 2, but Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should heed him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go." Sarna points out an interesting juxtaposition. When God appeared before Moses at the burning bush, Moses' first response was a rather humble, "Who am I?" Pharaoh, in contrast, responds to the idea of God with, "Who is the Lord?" These opposing responses of Moses and Pharaoh highlight their fundamentally different orientations. Moses sees himself as a simple human being, the most humble of men, as the Torah later tells us, Numbers chapter 12, verse 3. In contrast, Pharaoh sees himself, as do the Egyptians, as a divine being. His arrogance, as reflected in his contemptuous statement, "Who is the Lord?" is what God recognizes needs to be crushed. Moses then says what he was told to say. Verse 3. They answered, "The God of the Hebrews has manifested himself to us. Let us go, we pray, a distance of 3 days into the wilderness to sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he strike us with pestilence or sword." Apparently, Moses realizes he has not followed God's exact instructions, tries again, and gets it right. First, he uses the name God instructed him to use when speaking to Pharaoh. It makes more sense for Moses to refer to God as God of the Hebrews rather than as God of Israel, because Pharaoh uses the term Hebrews to refer to his slaves. Second, Moses speaks politely as God originally directed. "Let us go, we pray." Third, he now says, as instructed, "lest he," God, "strike us with pestilence or sword." This is obviously a threat to the Israelites. If Pharaoh doesn't acquiesce, the Hebrews will suffer at the hands of God for neglecting their obligations to him. But it also threatens Pharaoh with a work stoppage if the slaves are struck with pestilence or sword. Verse 4. But the king of Egypt said to them, "Moses and Aaron, why do you distract the people from their tasks? Get to your labors." Pharaoh blames Moses and Aaron for the punishment he is about to inflict on the Israelites. So will the Israelites. Verse 5. And Pharaoh continued, "The people of the land are already so numerous, and you would have them cease from their labors." A form of the Hebrew word hishbatem, translated here as cease from their labors, is still used to refer to a worker's strike, shvita. The root of both is shavat, the Hebrew consonants for Sabbath. Pharaoh is essentially accusing Moses and Aaron of trying to rally the Hebrew slaves to go on strike, which is an overstatement on Pharaoh's part, since Moses and Aaron were asking for only a few days off from work. Verse 6. That same day, Pharaoh charged the taskmasters and foremen of the people, saying, "Pharaoh issues his decree on the very same day Moses and Aaron come before him, to make it clear they are to blame for the increased workload. He is trying to turn the Hebrews against Moses and Aaron." Verse 7. "You shall no longer provide the people with straw for making bricks as heretofore. Let them go and gather straw for themselves." Verse 8. "But impose upon them the same quota of bricks as they have been making heretofore. Do not reduce it, for they are shirkers. That is why they cry, 'Let us go and sacrifice to our God.'" Verse 9. "Let heavier work be laid upon the men. Let them keep at it and not pay attention to deceitful promises." Verse 10. "So the taskmasters and foremen of the people went out and said to the people." The Hebrew slaves had two levels of overseers who supervised them. the Hebrew foremen, and above them, the Egyptian taskmasters. Thousands of years later, the Nazis adopted a similar governing structure in their concentration camps. They appointed kapos, prisoners who were themselves often Jews, over the Jewish prisoners, and appointed Nazi soldiers over the kapos. Verse 10 continued, "Thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you any straw." "Thus says" is often used in the Bible in referring to a royal pronouncement. Moses uses the term when referring to God to communicate that God is king, indeed the King of Kings. Verse 11, "You must go and get the straw yourselves wherever you can find it, but there shall be no decrease whatever in your work." Verse 12, "Then the people scattered throughout the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw." Verse 13, "And the taskmasters pressed them, saying, you must complete the same work assignment each day as when you had straw." Verse 14, "And the foremen of the Israelites, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten. Why, they were asked, did you not complete the prescribed amount of bricks, either yesterday or today, as you did before?" According to Rashi, the Israelite foremen were beaten because they could not bear to force their fellow Hebrews to fulfill the impossible quotas the Egyptians demanded. The foremen, therefore, had to face the beatings of the Egyptian taskmasters. As noted, Pharaoh and his taskmasters sought to induce hatred of Moses among the Hebrew foremen, and presumably among the slaves as well. And as verse 21 makes clear, they understandably succeeded. When the Hebrew foremen came upon Moses and Aaron, they said to them, "May the Lord look upon you and punish you for making us loathsome to Pharaoh." Verse 15, "Then the foremen of the Israelites came to Pharaoh and cried, 'Why do you deal thus with your servants?'" The word servants, or slaves, the Hebrew uses the same word for both, and it is not possible to always know when the Torah is referring to servants or slaves, appears three times in the next two verses, highlighting the submissive stance of the Hebrew foreman relative to the Egyptian taskmasters. A sociological note: that the Hebrew word for servants is the same as the word for slaves may help explain why Jews have historically been reluctant to take on positions of servitude or positions that even imply servitude. Thus, while most people, when speaking of their employment, say, "I work for so-and-so," Jews are more apt to say, "I work with so-and-so." Verse 16, "No straw is issued to your servants, yet they demand of us, 'Make bricks.' Thus your servants are being beaten when the fault is with your own people." Verse 17, "He replied, 'You are shirkers, shirkers. That is why you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord.'" Verse 18, "Be off now to your work. No straw shall be issued to you, but you must produce your quota of bricks." Throughout history, slaves were almost always regarded as less than human. Therefore, they could be subjected to great cruelty, sometimes emanating from sheer sadism. The universal practice of slavery and the accompanying horrible treatment of slaves is one of the many reasons it is absurd to believe people are basically good. See the commentary on Genesis chapter 8, verse 21. Verse 19. "Now the foremen of the Israelites found themselves in trouble because of the order, 'You must not reduce your daily quantity of bricks.'" The foremen are the ones who must now relay Pharaoh's cruel and impossible orders to their fellow Hebrews. Verse 20, "As they left Pharaoh's presence, they came upon Moses and Aaron standing in their path." Verse 21, "And they said to them, 'May the Lord look upon you and punish you for making us loathsome to Pharaoh and his courtiers, putting a sword in their hands to slay us.'" The foreman's anger is completely understandable. They would have much preferred that Moses and Aaron never went before Pharaoh. All it seems to have done is make matters worse. It can be difficult to love both humans and God at the same time. Verse 22. "Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, 'O Lord, why did you bring harm upon this people?'" Moses witnesses the suffering of the slaves, and because of his hatred of evil, he cries out against God. Moses' cry to God exemplifies the reality that it can be difficult to simultaneously love both humans and God. If we truly love human beings, we can become so upset by the pain they endure, we have trouble loving the God who allows such suffering. On the other hand, there are people who are so preoccupied with God, they don't permit themselves to fully feel the pain of human beings. One example is those in any religion who leave the world to immerse themselves in a religious life and ignore human suffering. The Torah's goal is that we love both man and God. This is Moses' predicament. But it is Pharaoh, not God, who is the one responsible for the Hebrew suffering. All anger should be directed at him. It is okay to get angry with God. Verse 22 continued, "Why did you send me?" Moses criticizes God both for making his mission unsuccessful and for sending him to Egypt in the first place. On some level, however, God has already responded to this charge. At the burning bush, God told Moses Pharaoh would refuse to let the Israelites leave. God does not become angry with Moses for his outburst. He understands that in the face of great evil, it can be very difficult to trust him or to understand his seeming passivity. God's non-reaction to Moses' outburst means all of us, not just Moses, are allowed to cry out against God when we are confronted with great evil, whether done to us or others. It is important to recall the name of the Jewish people. Israel means struggle or wrestle with God. Genesis chapter 32, verse 29. Of course, Moses' anger with God does not lead him to doubt God's existence. He had, after all, spoken with God at the burning bush. But Moses does doubt God will deliver on his promise to save the Israelites. His reaction illustrates the two types of faith: faith in God's existence and faith in God's trustworthiness. Like Moses, we too can become angry with God and even doubt his trustworthiness. These are perfectly understandable responses to the reality of evil in the world. However, evil should not lead us to doubt God's existence. We need to be intellectually consistent. If the existence of evil argues for no God, then the existence of goodness must argue for God. Verse 23. "Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has dealt worse with this people, and still you have not delivered your people." When we want something good to happen, we can become very impatient. The words, "ever since I came to Pharaoh," suggests Moses' effort had been going on for a long time. But of course, this was only his first meeting with Pharaoh. We all want good to prevail over evil immediately, and it would be nice if it did. But more often, this case being one of them, it doesn't. Hence the need for perseverance, faith, and hope. Chapter 6, verse 1. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'You shall soon see what I will do to Pharaoh. He shall let them go because of a greater might. Indeed, because of a greater might, he shall drive them from his land.'" God does not respond to Moses' accusations at the end of the previous chapter, that the mission has not only not succeeded, it has increased the suffering of the enslaved Israelites. There is an important Talmudic principle that states silence in the face of an accusation is, in effect, acknowledgement that the accusation is true. By saying nothing, God may be acknowledging it is understandable. Moses harbors doubts that God will carry out what he promised to do. And at least thus far, following God's instructions has actually made things worse for the Israelites. Now God does respond, not to the accusations, but more likely to build up Moses' trust and hope. God even more emphatically promises to deliver on his word, and tells Moses he will do so now. Verse 2, "God spoke to Moses and said to him, 'I am the Lord.'" Verse 3, "I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai, but I did not make myself known to them by my name," YHVH. As related in Exodus chapter 3 verse 15, God reveals the name YHWH to Moses. Verse 4. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they lived as sojourners. The Israeli Bible scholar Nechama Leibowitz